Tips and Other Snoops. Obama's civilian army scheme is only the latest in attempts to recruit Americans to spy on their fellow Americans. In midsummer 2002, a program called TIPS, or Terrorism Information and Prevention System, was launched by President George W. Bush. The program was part of a larger program called the Citizen Corps, which was a program first created by President Bush to mobilize the nation's citizenry against national security threats. On its website, TIPS describes itself as a national system for concerned workers to report suspicious activity. In published material, TIPS advocates said the program was to be administered by the Justice Department, coordinated by FEMA, and operated under the Homeland Security Department. It would involve millions of American workers who, in the daily course of their work, are in a unique position to see potentially unusual or suspicious activity in public places. This, of course, referred to postal carriers, meter readers, repair personnel, or anyone who might have an axe to grind against their neighbors. The program was quickly dropped, however, following public outrage, and after the U.S. Postal Service stated that it would not participate in the snitch program. The U.S. Postal Service stated it had been approached by Homeland Security regarding Operation TIPS. However, it was decided that the Postal Service and its letter carriers would not be participating in the program at this time. Nothing was mentioned about whether or not individual carriers could join on their own or if, at this time, left open the possibility that the Postal Service may participate in TIPS in the future. Despite the Postal Service's public reticence, some researchers believe that Postal Service employees may still be reporting suspicious behavior. It is just not done officially. Other critics immediately compared the TIPS plan to the Nazi Gestapo, the former East German secret police service, and to Fidel Castro's Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, or CDR, an organization established by Castro on September 28, 1960. With the CDR, Cubans are encouraged to spy on and report any counter-revolutionary behavior of their neighbors. An estimated 8 million Cubans belong to more than 121,000 committees in the CDR system. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and other public watchdog organizations reacted negatively to Operation TIPS, saying it would create an atmosphere in which Americans would be spying on one another. The administration apparently wants to implement a program that will turn local cable or gas or electrical technicians into government-sanctioned peeping toms, declared ACLU Legislative Counsel Rachel King. Of TIPS, Rutherford Institute Executive Director John Whitehead said, "This is George Orwell's 1984. It is an absolutely horrible and very dangerous idea. It's making Americans into government snoops. President Bush wants the average American to do what the FBI should be doing. In the end, though, nothing is going to prevent terrorists from crashing airplanes into buildings." Even former Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge was forced to backpedal over the TIPS organization, saying, "The last thing we want is Americans spying on Americans." Although Ridge still vouched for the TIPS program, the Citizen Corps softened both its language and details about the program after it began to make a national stir. In July 2002, the website stated Operation TIPS will be a nationwide program giving millions of American truckers, letter carriers, train conductors, ship captains, utility employees, and others a formal way to report suspicious terrorist activity. Operation TIPS, a project of the U.S. Department of Justice, will begin as a pilot program in 10 cities. Operation TIPS involves 1 million workers in the pilot stage, will be a national reporting system that allows workers, whose routines make them well-positioned to recognize unusual events, to report suspicious activity. Everywhere in America, a concerned worker can call a toll-free number and be connected directly to a hotline, routing calls to the proper law enforcement agency or other responder organizations when appropriate. In an Orwellian act of word-changing, by early August 2002, the list of occupations that would participate in TIPS was dropped and the words "suspicious terrorist activity" and "unusual events, suspicious activity" were changed to suspicious and potentially terrorist-related activity, and potentially unusual or suspicious activity in public places. The TIPS program was merely an official way for Americans to snoop, and further what author Jim Redden called modern society's snitch culture. From the school kid drug abuse resistance education, DARE program, to professional finger pointers such as the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, more and more Americans were being encouraged to spy and report on one another. It's one thing to keep an eye out for strangers in the neighborhood, and quite another to constantly snoop on the activities of neighbors. Many people believe that neighborhood snooping went out with Bush-era fear-mongering. However, these people should know that the Major Cities Chiefs Association, which includes police chiefs from 63 of the largest departments in the United States and Canada, endorsed a program called iWatch during an annual conference in Denver on October 3, 2009. Los Angeles Police Chief William Bratton, whose department developed the iWatch program, called it the 21st century version of Neighborhood Watch. The program's watchword is, "If you see something, say something." As a policy counsel for the ACLU and a former FBI agent who worked terrorism cases, Mike German was unenthusiastic about iWatch despite assurances that the program would not infringe on individual liberties. German told the Associated Press he suspects people will fall back on personal biases and stereotypes of what they think a terrorist should look like when deciding to report someone to the police. He said, "That just plays into the negative elements of society and doesn't really help the situation." There have been many cases where innocent people have had their lives unsettled, ruined, or even lost due to egregious snitching. Although these stories are usually not played up in the corporate mass media, the purchase of snitch information continues to be a mainstay of federal law enforcement. In 1994, the DEA spent $31.7 million and Customs spent $16.5 million to pay thousands of informants. Although accurate numbers are hard to come by, former Miami police supervisor and DEA special agent Dennis G. Fitzgerald's book, Informants and Undercover Investigations, reported that a 2005 Inspector General's report revealed the DEA has about 4,000 confidential sources at hand on any given day. They may be paid up to $100,000 a year for their information, although their paycheck must be approved by DEA headquarters. The FBI can pay up to $25,000 to informants for information on serious crimes. Under a program called Rewards for Justice, both the U.S. State and Treasury Departments can offer money to informants for information leading to the arrest and conviction of any terrorist or terrorist group. By September 2005, more than $50 million had been paid out from this fund. One can only imagine how the lure of $100,000 to $1 million simply to find some sort of terrorist activity could highly induce a greedy person to make false claims. Asset Forfeiture Fund. Much of the money paid to government informants comes from the Asset Forfeiture Fund, AFF, a controversial program that confiscates real assets such as property, homes, cars, aircraft, boats, jewelry, financial instruments, and even whole businesses from those convicted of a crime. In 2005 alone, $614.5 million worth of assets were deposited into the AFF. Under the AFF, there are two types of forfeiture, criminal and civil. In a criminal forfeiture case, the defendant is always innocent until proven guilty, and it is the responsibility of the prosecution to prove that the defendant should forfeit his or her property. In civil forfeiture proceedings, the court presumes the defendant is guilty, and the property owner has the burden of proving the property was not involved in any wrongdoing. Critics have complained that the AFF can seize an innocent person's property, even if it is used by someone else to commit a crime without the owner's permission or knowledge. Forfeiture laws have now been used by local law enforcement in connection with local issues, including unsafe housing, prostitution, and even drunk driving. The AFF's property seizures prompted Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Henry Hyde, to state, "They don't have to convict you. They don't even have to charge you with the crime, but they have your property." Bob Barr, a Libertarian Party presidential nominee in 2008, noted, "In many jurisdictions, it has become a monetary tail wagging the law enforcement dog. The practice of confiscating property has prompted protests from civil libertarians and attorneys, but in today's fearful society, the protests have not worked." Chemtrails. In April 2009, President Obama's science advisor, John P. Holdren, stated publicly that the federal government was going to increase geoengineering, perhaps to include spraying pollutants into the upper atmosphere to retard global warming. Some suspicious researchers saw this as the first public acknowledgement of what many people believe is a controversial aerial spraying program known as chemtrails. Holdren gave no details on what the pollutant particles might be, nor did he explain how they would be dispersed into the sky. Some scientists, including the late Dr. Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, a founder of the Star Wars missile defense system, and the inspiration for the character Dr. Strangelove in Stanley Kubrick's 1964 film of that name, have proposed using balloons or military aircraft to seed the sky with millions of tons of sulfur or heavy metals to create a cloud cover to deflect sun rays and prevent further heating of the earth. Some scientists warned such a program would turn blue skies milky white and perhaps cause droughts and further ozone depletion. Holdren conceded the possibility of graveside effects, but said, "We might get desperate enough to want to use it." Many researchers and bloggers believe that Holdren's proposed program has been secretly underway since about 1997. Reports of chemtrails, jet plumes emitted from planes that hang in the air for hours and do not dissipate like condensation trails, often blanketing the sky in crisscross patterns, have increased dramatically over the last 10 years. Many have speculated that they are part of a government program to alter climate, inoculate humans against certain pathogens, or even to toxify humans as part of a population reduction agenda, stated one such article entitled "Weather Wars and Chemtrails." The project is closely tied to an idea by Nobel Prize winner Paul Crutzen, who proposed sending aircraft 747s to dump huge quantities of sulfur particles into the far reaches of the stratosphere to cool down the atmosphere. Such programs merely scratch the surface of what is likely to be a gargantuan and overarching black budget-funded project to geoengineer the planet. With little or no care for unknown environmental consequences this could engender. Obama augmented this potential public hazard by appointing people to the Department of Agriculture who were fully aligned with genetic engineering, the use of fluoride, and the irradiation of food. As usual, this was done in the name of public health. Global swarming. Adding to controversies over the environment was the fact that the scientific community hasn't even reached a consensus about whether or not the planet is warming. As it stands, scientists may be arguing forever. Contradicting reports further complicated the debate. In the spring of 2009, news headlines proclaimed Antarctic ice melting faster than expected. Only 1 week later, there were headlines reading Antarctic ice spreading. Both events were blamed on an increase in man-made gases. Clearly, something is happening to the planet, because data continue to indicate that something is quickly changing the planet's Arctic regions. The latest satellite observations of sea ice in the Arctic show the ice cover appears to be shrinking, and the ice cap is getting smaller and thinner as well. The ice has been receding more in the summers and not growing back to its previous size and thickness during the winters. But what if it's the case that politics and not solid science is behind the endless global warming debate? The debate intensified in 2006 with the release of former Vice President Al Gore's documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. Since its release, Gore has traveled the world forcefully arguing that human-generated carbon emissions from automobiles, aircrafts, and factories are the cause of the Earth's warming trend. But Gore's critics have pointed out that huge profits can be made from being a global warming alarmist, and that Gore heads a firm that is in line to reap the benefits of Gore's eco-conservatism. According to online reports, Gore helped found Generation Investment Management, which invests in solar, wind, and other projects that reduce energy consumption around the globe. Critics claim that as chairman of the firm, Gore stands to profit handsomely from his global environmental crusade. With great irony, the Tennessee Center for Policy Research, TCPR, criticized Gore by pointing out that Gore's Tennessee home used 20 times as much electricity as the average household nationwide. Gore supporters pointed out that Gore's home of 20 rooms needed special security measures, and that the Gore family bought energy produced from renewable sources, such as wind and solar. However, the TCPR reported that, according to its analysis, the Gores still consumed 10% more yearly energy than before their home was equipped with eco-friendly energy-saving devices. Despite news reporters on his home as an energy hog by Fox News and Business Week, a Gore spokeswoman defended his lifestyle by countering that his investments in renewable energy compensated for his power consumption. When Texas Republican Representative Joe Barton tried to question Al Gore's carbon emissions statistics during testimony before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the former vice president compared scientists who questioned global warming to indicted stock swindler Bernie Madoff. "It is important to look at sources of science you rely on," Gore told Barton. "With all due respect, I believe you have relied on people you have trusted who have given you bad information. I don't blame the investors who trusted Bernie Madoff, but he gave them bad information." Confusion over the global warming issue's legitimacy continued with the news that, in August 2009, the University of East Anglia's Climate Research Unit, CRU, admitted it had destroyed the raw data for its global surface temperature research because of an alleged lack of storage space. CRU data served as the foundation for several major international studies claiming that the Earth's global warming crisis is a real issue. These studies were used to gain support for the cap-and-trade legislation passed by Congress in mid-2009, officially called the American Clean Air and Security Act. CRU's destruction of data, however, severely undercuts the credibility of those studies, stated a news release from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI, a Washington-based public interest group dedicated to free enterprise and limited government. In October 2009, the advocacy group petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, to review its policies based on the CRU research. CEI General Counsel Sam Kasman said, "EPA is resting its case on international studies that in turn relied on CRU data, but CRU's suspicious destruction of its original data, disclosed at this late date, makes that information totally unreliable. If EPA doesn't re-examine the implications of this, it's stumbling blindly into the most important regulatory issue we face." Some critics claim that Gore is operating on bad information as well, and note that the current warming trend may include our entire solar system. Polar caps on Mars are shrinking, ice is melting on the moons of Jupiter, and the outer planets appear more luminescent, which is an indication that they too are warming. Speculation over why the solar system is warming system-wide ranges from lack of sunspot activity to the approach of some celestial object. If the entire solar system is warming, then this theory calls into question the idea that global warming on Earth is only induced by humans. On May 19, 2009, record low spring temperatures were recorded in 28 states. If there had been record warmth in 28 states, you would have seen "We're Causing Global Warming" headlines plastered across the front page of almost every newspaper in the country, and TV hosts would have gleefully announced the dire news. But had you even heard about this? Asked author and attorney Alfred Lambremont Weber, who, along with former Fairchild Industries corporate manager Dr. Carol Rosen, founded the Institute for Cooperation in Space. Proponents on both sides of issues, such as the global warming argument, accuse each other of using fear-mongering tactics to impose a police state on the public. The federal EPA pointed to the combustion of fossil fuels in vehicles, gas and coal plants, and industry as the world's largest source of carbon dioxide, CO2, or greenhouse gas emissions. This conclusion remains controversial. In December 2009, the EPA went so far as to declare carbon dioxide, a product of normal human expiration, we all breathe out CO2, a health hazard, paving the way for more regulation of emissions. Adding to the argument that the government is using fear-mongering to achieve control over a dumbed-down public, Richard S. Lindzen, a professor of atmospheric science at MIT, pointed out that CO2 is not a pollutant. It's a product of every living creature's breathing. It's the product of all plant respiration. It is essential for plant life and photosynthesis. It's a product of all industrial burning. It's a product of driving. I mean, if you ever wanted a leverage point to control everything from exhalation to driving, this would be a dream. So it has a kind of fundamental attractiveness to bureaucratic mentality, he said. Fears over global warming resulted in the controversial American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009, legislation that requires a limit or cap of how much CO2 a company may emit into the air. Companies that reduce CO2 more rapidly than others may conduct emission trading, selling or trading their emission credits to firms that overproduce. Opponents of cap and trade voiced fears over loss of jobs and federal control not only over businesses but private homes. Despite a narrow House victory, 219 to 212, Speaker Nancy Pelosi pronounced, "We passed transformational legislation which takes us into the future." She took congratulatory phone calls from Obama, Al Gore, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Obama had joined the Global Warming Chorus in April 2007 with a plan for a National Low Carbon Fuel Standard, NLCFS. Speaking to students at the University of New Hampshire's Durham campus, then-Senator Obama proclaimed, "This is our generation's moment to save future generations from global catastrophe by creating a market for clean-burning fuels that can stop the dangerous transformation of our climate." In states like New Hampshire and California, people are taking the lead on producing fuels that use less carbon. It's time we made this a national commitment to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and take the equivalent of 32 million cars worth of pollution out of the atmosphere. His fervent support for reducing vehicle pollution indicated that Obama either did not truly understand what is causing solar system-wide warming, or has fallen in line with the globalist attempt to control the lives of individuals through the scare tactics of global warming. A police state. A state of war only serves as an excuse for domestic tyranny. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Nobel Prize-winning novelist and survivor of the communist Gulag system. Fear-mongering has always been a favored tool of despots and tyrants trying to limit public freedom. Only dazed zombies accept increasing social control by allowing threats of terrorism and depression to be held over their heads. Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. Imagine a pimple-faced 18-year-old dressed in camouflage and armed with a fully loaded M16 at your door informing you, you must leave your home because the authorities fear a pandemic in your city. If you protest and say you'll stay and take your chances, you are in violation of the law and subject to arrest, fine, and imprisonment. After seeing the boy's armed companions, you decide to join your neighbors in a military truck destined for a relocation camp many miles from your home. At the camp, you are instructed to stand in line for a vaccination against flu, smallpox, anthrax, or whatever the latest threat might be. You recall how, in past years, so many vaccines were proven to be tainted. Yet if you refuse the inoculation, you are again subject to fine and jail. If this sounds like a paranoid view of an Orwellian nightmare, it should be noted that since 2002, laws authorizing such action had already been passed in 38 states and the District of Columbia. Under this act, named the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, authorities would be able to federalize all medical personnel, from EMTs to physicians, and enforce quarantines. They would have the right to vaccinate the public, with or without its consent, seize and destroy private property without compensation, and ration medical supplies, food, fuel, and water in a declared emergency. The legislation was drawn up as a model law for the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention following the anthrax attacks that occurred in the Capitol after 9/11. Not much has been mentioned in recent years about these attacks. What many don't know is that investigations showed that the anthrax pathogens from the attacks were military grade and unavailable outside the U.S. Armed Forces. To date, one suspect was exonerated after several years, and the next man named in those attacks died while in federal custody. After being passed, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act was then sent to each state legislature with a federal endorsement. Federal officials claimed the laws were needed to provide local authorities the legal right to make quick decisions in an emergency involving contagious or deadly pathogens. Though many states modified or outright rejected this legislation, no one should relax just yet. Government camps. The creation of internment or relocation camps in times of crisis is nothing new. During the war between the states, President Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, a critical mainstay of American justice that allows defendants the rights to face their accusers. This action was later overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court because Lincoln did not previously obtain approval from Congress to suspend habeas corpus. But then, during World War I, the Supreme Court upheld the right of the president to seize the property of enemy aliens without a hearing. The court stated, "National security might not be able to afford the luxuries of litigation and the long delays which preliminary hearings traditionally have entailed." These words led to the Supreme Court consent for the rounding up, incarceration, and property seizure of Japanese Americans following the attack on Pearl Harbor. Even former Attorney General Janet Reno, who headed the U.S. Department of Justice during the tragedies at Ruby Ridge and Waco, expressed concern over the creation of a martial state. "I have trouble with a war that has no end game, and I have trouble with a war that generates so many concerns about individual liberties," she told an audience at Old Dominion University in 2002. Reno asked Americans to remember the lessons learned from the unjust imprisonment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and added that the government would be hard-pressed to find a legal basis for prosecuting many of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners detained at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Initially, most Americans thought little of jailing terrorism suspects in Cuba. It was only after the prosecutions that followed the horrors at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq that the average American began to question the American military's methods. Democratic Senator Richard J. Durbin, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, tried for more than 2 years to conduct hearings on the treatment of the Guantanamo prisoners. Durbin had spent 6.5 years as a prisoner in North Vietnam. "This is not a new question," he told fellow Congress members in 2005. "We are not writing on a blank slate. We have entered into treaties over the years, saying this is how we will treat wartime detainees. The United States has ratified these treaties. They are the law of the land as much as any statute we passed. They have served our country well in past wars. We have held ourselves to be a civilized country, willing to play by the rules, even in time of war. Unfortunately, without even consulting Congress, the Bush administration unilaterally decided to set aside these treaties and create their own rules about the treatment of prisoners." Durbin pointed out that President Bush and his appointees had unilaterally created a new detention policy based on the belief that prisoners in the war on terrorism have no legal rights, no right to a lawyer, no right to see the evidence against them, no right to challenge their detention. In fact, the U.S. government has claimed detainees have no right to challenge their detention even if they claim they were being tortured. For example, he explained, they, the Bush administration, have even argued in court they have the right to indefinitely detain an elderly lady from Switzerland who writes checks to what she thinks is a charity that helps orphans, but actually is a front that finances terrorism. Senator Durbin shocked his colleagues and angered Bush supporters when he cited an FBI account of how Guantanamo prisoners had been chained to cells in extreme temperatures and deprived of food and water. Durbin stated, "If I read this to you and did not tell you that it was an FBI agent describing what Americans had done to prisoners in their control, you would most certainly believe this must have been done by Nazis, Soviets, in their gulags, or some mad regime, Pol Pot or others, that had no concern for human beings. Sadly, that is not the case. This was the action of Americans in the treatment of their prisoners." It is disturbing to note that some days later, Durbin was forced to issue an apology. A tearful Durbin told his fellows, "Some may believe that my remarks crossed the line. To them, I extend my heartfelt apologies." Is this what happens to a person who brings reason and compassion to the table amid fear-mongering? There are those who claim that the quarantine centers, such as the one at Guantanamo, are simply unsubstantiated theory. These people should think again. One of former Attorney General John Ashcroft's visions was to have the power to strip American citizens of their constitutional rights, including access to the court system. Ashcroft wanted to indefinitely imprison those citizens considered enemy combatants in internment camps. The proposed camp plan should trigger immediate congressional hearings and reconsideration of Ashcroft's fitness for this important office, declared Jonathan Turley, a professor of constitutional law at George Washington University Law School. Turley, who previously actively supported Ashcroft during his contentious nomination hearing, reflected, "Whereas Al-Qaeda is a threat to the lives of our citizens, Ashcroft has become a clear and present threat to our liberties." Apparently, Ashcroft's plan to build camps was continued after he left office in February 2005. In January 2006, the engineering and construction subsidiary of Halliburton Company, KBR, announced it was awarded a contingency contract from the Department of Homeland Security to construct emergency facilities in support of its Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, unit. The maximum total value of the contract is $385 million and consists of a one-year base period with 4 one-year options. KBR had been working under similar grants since 2002. This call for contractors to build holding camps only increased the anxiety of conspiracy theorists. Such facilities, whether in the form of empty but maintained military bases or newly built accommodations, do exist in the United States. They only await inmates. Camp FEMA. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is designated as the lead agency concerned with detention centers under the Department of Homeland Security. This organization has plans in its files to evacuate cities and use sprawling temporary camps to house evacuees. Under the pretext of planning for a war on terrorism, FEMA has dusted off and augmented contingency plans to counter the effects of nuclear, biological, and chemical attacks. In mid-2002, FEMA asked its vendors, contractors, and consultants to envision the logistics of millions of Americans being displaced in the event that American cities come under attack. The firms were given a deadline of January 2003 to be ready to establish displaced persons camps. FEMA made it known that it already had ordered significant numbers of tents and trailers to be used for housing. The internet is full of sites detailing a string of concentration camps across America, many based on ill-informed rumor and speculation. But others are quite real, ready and waiting for lines of detainees or dissidents to be herded inside. While some may cast this off as paranoia, these camps do exist. Most of them are situated in military bases that are reported closed or maintained by skeleton crews. Others are operated by FEMA. Some facilities began as World War II camps for Axis prisoners. During the Clinton administration, the Base Realignment and Closing, or BRAC, program closed several bases, but kept them maintained for future use in case of national emergency, be it war, pandemic, insurrection, or natural disaster. All bases have barracks, dining facilities, latrines, and showers, and can house thousands of people on short notice. Military installations that have been designated as such centers include Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, an active National Guard training base with hundreds of buildings that include barracks, warehouses, mess halls, motor transport facilities, and a railroad track with loading docks. This facility was converted into a concentration camp within 72 hours to house Mariel Boatlift refugees from Cuba in 1980 and Vietnamese refugees following the fall of Saigon. Warehouses at Fort Chaffee currently hold massive amounts of barbed wire, fencing material, mattresses, blankets, and other supplies. Eglin Air Force Base, Florida, has also been used to hold various refugees in the past, primarily Cubans. Other military bases designated as potential detention centers include McAllister Ammunition Depot and Fort Sill in Oklahoma, Fort Drum, New York, Fort Irwin and 29 Palms Marine Corps Base, California, Fort Lewis, Washington, Fort Bliss, Texas, Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, Camp Grayling, Michigan, Fort Riley, Kansas, and Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. Author and retired U.S. Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Craig Roberts said he chased down a number of rumors and third-hand accounts of American concentration camps and found many untrue or outdated. But he also found some sites fully ready to operate as detention facilities. Roberts explained, "In actuality, there are two true sets of camps. First is military, which can use any base at will to house detainees. Fort Chaffee, for instance, has already been used twice for this purpose, first with the Cuban boat people and second for Vietnamese refugees. It continues to have warehouses full of mattresses, bunks, barbed wire rolls, fence posts, etc. All of these were to be used around empty barracks to provide for a detention facility if needed. Some of the closed military bases have been designated as emergency holding facilities and already have barracks, mess halls, compounds, and latrines in place. All they need are guards, administrators, logistics people, and they're in business. All this can be accomplished in 72 hours. Operational plans are in existence for the handling of civilian prisoners and laborers on military installations, both male and female. The second category is FEMA. We know they have let a contract for 1,000 emergency relocation camps in case of widespread terrorism, biological or chemical attacks on the cities. Again, this can be speedy. The president can declare a national emergency, evoke Executive Order 11490, and take over the country without deferring to Congress or the Constitution. Bingo! New World Order in a couple of days. Robert said the worst of these camps is in Alaska. There is a million-acre facility near Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska that is called the Alaska Mental Health Facility, said Roberts. An exercise by the Air Force was conducted in the mid-90s, where they tested how many cargo aircraft could fly in and out of Elmendorf from all over the country in a three-day period, operating 24/7. To me, there is only one cargo that they would be taking from all over the country to Alaska, right next to the mental health facility, and that's people. You can look it up yourself. I think it's the Alaska Mental Health Act, dated 1955 or 56. The place has been federalized and still exists. It's our version of Siberia and the Gulag. On January 22, 2009, Democratic Representative Al C. Hastings of Florida moved to legalize relocation camps by introducing H.R. 645, the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act. the purpose of the bill was to direct the Secretary of Homeland Security to establish national emergency centers on military installations. The bill was referred to the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, in addition to the Committee on Armed Services, then later to the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Unconventional Threats and Capabilities, where it remained as of early 2010. With members of the military being called upon to combat terrorism and illegal drugs, many fear military control over the civilian population, even in times of national emergency, will lead to draconian measures such as the establishment of large concentration camps. The original creation and maintenance of such camps has been lost in a bewildering maze of executive orders, EOs, dating back to World War II. Other relocation EOs can be traced to the Kennedy presidency and were issued under the duress of the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis. A brief search of the FEMA website shows that even now the government has many plans to evacuate major cities, whether it be because of tornadoes, hurricanes, flooding, or a nuclear or biological strike. Where are those people to go? Who will feed them? How will they live? The answers to these questions remain elusive, and in the meantime, dozens of large military installations sit, mutely awaiting future inhabitants. Alongside many former military bases that are technically closed but still being maintained, a growing number of civilian locations are being prepared for any emergency. One such facility is the State Fair of Virginia's new home in Caroline County, designated as an emergency shelter in any emergency requiring a mass evacuation. The fair opened in late September 2009 on a new 360-acre site, formerly known as Meadow Farm. The fair was a result of a 2007 deal between the State Fair of Virginia Incorporated and the Virginia Department of Emergency Management. The 20-year agreement was reached after the state agreed to appropriate about $2.4 million to help build the main exhibition hall, which officials said could house almost 1,500 people in the event of an emergency. Under the agreement, the facility is required to have a kitchen capable of preparing up to 6,500 meals a day, restrooms that can accommodate more than 2,200 people, backup generator power, 10 acres of parking lots suitable for emergency response operations, and two 20,000-square-feet paved pads that could be used for tents or other temporary structures to include sheltering household pets. In case doubts remain that the government is building and maintaining internment camps, the U.S. Army advertised jobs in 2009 for internment resettlement specialists. These specialists, according to an Army description, are primarily responsible for day-to-day operations in a military confinement slash correctional facility or detention slash internment facility. IR specialists provide rehabilitative, health, welfare, and security to U.S. military prisoners within a confinement or correctional facility, conduct inspections, prepare written reports, and coordinate activities of prisoners, internees, and staff personnel. Why are all these specialists needed? Clearly, there is no pressing need for additional personnel to intern or resettle the mere handful of Al-Qaeda members caught to date. Citizens should ask themselves who the quarantine centers are being prepared for and what sort of resettlement program these specialists will administer. American Police Force. Adding to concerns over a police state presided over by FEMA, or the military, came word of what appeared to be the growth of private security contractors, similar to Blackwater, now Z Services LLC, and DynCorp. In September 2009, representatives from the American Police Force, or APF, held a news conference to announce plans to create a $27 million high-security prison and police training facility in Hardin, Montana. A spokesperson declined to name the force's parent company. Confusion and secrecy about American Police Force has grown during the last few weeks, noted reporters Nick Law and Katie Eusen of KURL8 TV News. While they gave details for the site, other questions went unanswered. Where will the prisoners come from? What experience does APF have in prisoners and training police officers? APF spokesperson Becky Shea denied there was any secrecy involved. APF has been here for 10 months, but it has never been stealth, said Shea, who had only days before taken the job of APF Public Relations Director after covering the detention facility story for the Billings Gazette. Shea assured the media that the private police group would not house terror suspects from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, a rumor that persisted in the area after the Hardin City Council approved the plan. Associated Press reporter Matthew Brown wrote that the Two Rivers Detention Center was promoted as the largest economic development project in decades in the small town of Hardin, where the jail was built 2 years ago. But it has been vacant ever since. Brown noted that the bonds used to finance the facility fell into default and that questions had arisen over the legitimacy of the APF. Government contract databases show no record of the company, wrote Brown. Security industry representatives and federal officials said they had never heard of it. On its website, the company lists as its headquarters a building in Washington near the White House that holds virtual offices. A spokeswoman for the building said American Police Force never completed its application to use the address. On its website, the APF claimed to sell assault rifles, weapons, and military supplies internationally while providing security, investigative work, and other services to clients in all 50 states and most countries. APF literature also boasted rapid response units awaiting our orders worldwide, capable of fielding a battalion-sized team of Special Forces soldiers within 72 hours. Maziar Mafi, a personal injury and medical malpractice attorney who was hired by APF, said APF was a new spin-off of a major security firm founded in 1984. He declined to name the parent firm. Oddly, the APF's logo is the double-headed eagle with fleur-de-lis emblem of the Republic of Serbia. Today, Serbia is a member of the United Nations, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and the Council of Europe, and is a candidate for membership in the European Union. Could there be a connection between the APF and the globalists? Writing anonymously due to fear of retaliation, one Hardin resident posted this on the internet. We have found out that our little town of Hardin is the test town for President Obama's new law to privatize the police force of local communities. Last night, September 4th, 2009, the City Council voted to disband our sheriff's department and to bring in a private security company to police the town. Interestingly, earlier in the day, the mayor, when asked in an interview about the privatization of our police department, completely denied it and said that would not be done without a council meeting. Then that evening, a council meeting was held in regards to that very thing. At the beginning of this month, our local prison signed an agreement with the American Police Force, which is a subsidiary of a larger private security force that the U.S. used in the Iraq War and Hurricane Katrina. Yesterday, a convoy of 12 blacked-out Mercedes-Benz SUVs were brought into town. They were already painted with Hardin's colors, and Hardin Police Force was already painted on them. Hardin's Sheriff's Department will no longer be in operation after the month of October. During October, the Sheriff's Department is to train this new security force in all the logistics of running the town of Hardin. If you go on the American Police Force site, you might notice that the logo they used is actually a Russian-Serbian logo. I've been told that the man who came with this new security force as the captain has a thick Russian accent. The story of Hardin and the APF reached the national media and prompted Montana Attorney General Steve Bullock to launch an investigation after it was learned that the man representing the APF, Captain Michael Hilton, was a Serbian immigrant with a long list of aliases. Apparently, Hilton had served time in U.S. prisons for fraud and had more than $1 million in judgments against him. While the corporate mass media only publicized the jobs that would be created in Hardin and speculated that the APF could be a con, the alternative media noted that the APF claimed to run the U.S. Training Center in Moyock, North Carolina, the same center connected to Blackwater, the controversial recipient of large U.S. government contracts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Officials at Z Blackwater tried to distance the company from the APF, stating the force was using its name illegally. Z spokeswoman Stacy DeLuke said, "It's bizarre. They have nothing to do with us. We have nothing to do with them." However, the contact address in Moyoc for both the U.S. Training Center, formerly the Blackwater Training Center, and the American Police Force was the same. Paul Joseph Watson, a researcher and columnist for talk show host Alex Jones' webpage, PrisonPlanet.com, wrote, "The fact that APF's training center plans to recruit foreign assets who could then be patrolling the streets of America bossing U.S. citizens is obviously a frightening prospect, completely unconstitutional, and another reason why APF needs to abandon its plans to act as a private police force completely." William N. Grigg, writing on the internet blog ProLiberate, observed there was something utterly surreal about the Hardin case. It's as if some kind of martial law melodrama were being played out as an enhanced reality program, something like Red Dawn meets Jericho with a touch of the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast added for good measure. The Posse Comitatus Act. Less than a month after the 9/11 attacks, former governor of Pennsylvania Tom Ridge arrived in his new office steps away from the Oval Office of President Bush, the man who created his job. Ridge's new job was to head up the recently created Office of Homeland Security, which would coordinate 46 different federal government agencies in an effort to protect the American people from terrorists. From its inception, the position was designed to become a permanent government department. By 2006, Ridge had used his power as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security to create a vast network of small suburban and rural counties that had their own Homeland Security departments and that were all answerable to the National Department. This concentration of so much power into the DHS under a leader with a controversial past has been cause for concern by many Americans. During the Vietnam War, Tom Ridge participated in the infamous Phoenix Program, a pacification program responsible for the assassination of 45,000 Vietnamese and the torture and abuse of thousands. Douglas Valentine, author of The Phoenix Program, wrote in a posting on the website disinfo.com, "During the Vietnam War, under the CIA's Phoenix Program, which is the model for the Homeland Security Office, a terrorist suspect was anyone accused by one anonymous source. Just one. The suspect was then arrested, indefinitely detained in a CIA interrogation center, tortured until he or she, in some cases children as young as 12, confessed, informed on others, died, or was brought before a military tribunal, such as Bush is proposing, for disposition. In thousands of cases, innocent people were imprisoned and tortured based on the word of an anonymous informer who had a personal grudge or was actually a Viet Cong double agent feeding the names of loyal citizens into the Phoenix blacklist. At no point in the process did suspects have access to due process or lawyers, and thus, in 1971, four U.S. congresspersons stated their belief that the Phoenix program violated that part of the Geneva Convention's guarantee to protect civilians in time of war. When Ridge was appointed, the White House announced that he would work in conjunction with Bush's Deputy National Security Advisor, U.S. Army General Wayne Downing. This announcement indicated to the public that the military would play a prominent role in counterterrorism activities. Few thought to ask if this was a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, or PCA, the law that prohibits the U.S. military from conducting law enforcement duties against the American public. The PCA has never really been challenged in this nation's history because it addresses a grievance that was used to proclaim the American Revolution when early colonists were forced to feed and quarter King George's troops while submitting to the troops' authority. The act embodies the traditional principle of separation of military and civilian authority. one of the fundamental precepts of a democratic government and a cornerstone of American liberty. Posse Comitatus, Latin for a support group of citizens for law enforcement, that is, a posse, wasn't passed until 1878. The act was a direct result of the outrage over Southern states being at the mercy of inept or corrupt military authorities during Reconstruction. The Posse Comitatus Act specifically prohibits most members of the armed services, the Coast Guard is exempted for its coastal protection duties, from exercising police powers on non-federal property within the United States. Posse Comitatus has been slowly shredded since 1981, when Congress allowed an exception to be made for the war on drugs. The military was allowed to be used for drug interdiction along the nation's borders. This small and what appeared to be sensible action at the time soon grew out of proportion. Congress, still unable to come to grips with the true social causes of drug abuse, in 1989 designated the Department of Defense as the lead agency in drug interdiction. In the tragedy at Waco on April 19, 1993, military snipers were on hand, and General Wesley Clark used tanks from Fort Hood to bulldoze the burning Branch Davidian Church. Clark's command was authorized because federal officials used the pretext that the Davidians were involved with drugs. No evidence of drugs was ever found. On April 19, 1995, the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City was bombed, and President Bill Clinton proposed yet another circumvention of the PCA to allow the military to help civilian investigators look for weapons of mass destruction. Around the same time, Congress considered legislation to allow troops to enforce customs and immigration laws at the borders. This legislation didn't pass. Only 1 year later, Bob Dole promised on the presidential campaign trail to heighten the military's role in the war on drugs. Another primary contender, Lamar Alexander, suggested that a new branch of the military be created to substitute for the INS and Border Patrol. By 2010, the Posse Comitatus Act was about finished after it was announced that for the first time an active U.S. Army unit, the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team, was to be redeployed inside the United States under the Northern Command, NORTHCOM. After spending 60 months in Iraq quelling insurgents, the team was available when called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control or deal with potentially horrific scenarios such as massive poisoning and chaos in response to a chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, or high-yield explosive, or CBRNE attack, subdue unruly or dangerous individuals. They carry equipment to construct roadblocks and install spike strips for slowing and stopping or controlling traffic, as well as shields, batons, and beanbag bullets for non-lethal crowd control. The need for reaffirmation of the PCA's principle is increasing, wrote legal scholar Matthew Hammond in the Washington University Law Quarterly, because in recent years, Congress and the public have seen the military as a panacea for domestic problems. He added, major and minor exceptions to the PCA, which allow the use of the military and law enforcement roles, blur the line between military and civilian roles, undermine civilian control of the military, damage military readiness, and inefficiently solve the problems they supposedly address. Additionally, increasing the role of the military would strengthen the federal law enforcement apparatus that is currently under close scrutiny for overreaching its authority. In the weeks following 9/11 and before the creation of the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, military troops patrolled airports and the streets of Washington and New York without protest. Such scenes were a brief glimpse of life under martial law. In 2005, President Bush announced that he would use military troops in the event of a national pandemic. In 2009, the military was an integral part of the swine flu general vaccination process. Why is it that the military's role in daily life has kept steadily increasing when the nation hasn't been attacked again? Could it be that the martial law was planned years ago? those who doubt the veracity of this should just ask the residents of Kingsville, Texas. On the night of February 8, 1999, a series of mock battles using live ammunition erupted around the town of 25,000. As part of a military operation named Operation Last Dance, 8 black helicopters roared over the town. Ferried by the choppers, soldiers of the elite 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, known as the Night Stalkers, staged an attack on 2 empty buildings using real explosives and live ammunition. One of the helicopters nearly crashed when it hit the top of a telephone pole and started a fire near a home. Additionally, an abandoned police station was accidentally set on fire and a gas station was badly damaged when one or more helicopters landed on its roof. Citizens of Kingsville were terrified during the drill. Police Chief Felipe Garza and Mayor Phil Esquivel were the only ones notified of the attack in advance. Both men refused to give any details of the operation, insisting they had been sworn to secrecy by the military. Only Arthur Rogers, the assistant police chief, would admit to what happened. The United States Army Special Operations Command was conducting a training exercise in our area, he said. He refused to provide any details. The local emergency management coordinator for FEMA, Thomas Sanchez, was not happy with the attack and with the lack of information and warning. When asked what the attack was all about, Sanchez, a decorated Vietnam veteran with 30 years' service in naval intelligence, replied that, based on his background and knowledge, the attack was an operational exercise. The scenario of the exercise was that martial law has been declared through the Presidential Powers and War Powers Act, and some citizens have refused to give up their weapons. They have taken over 2 of the buildings in Kingsville. The police cannot handle it, so you call these guys in. They show up and they zap everybody, take all the weapons, and let the local PD clean it up. Sanchez and other military experts told WorldNet Daily that the night attack indicated the use of Presidential Decision Directive PDD-25, a top-secret document that apparently authorizes military participation in domestic police situations. Some speculated that PDD-25 may have surreptitiously superseded the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act. Asked for comment, George W. Bush, then Texas governor, said it was not his job to get involved in the concerns over the Night Stalkers and the use of live ammunition in a civilian area of his state. Just in case one might be tempted to think that the events in Kingsville were simply some aberration from the distant past, a similar military exercise took place in 2009. Soldiers from Fort Campbell, including the 101st Airborne Division Air Assault, and other infantry brigades, performed a training air assault in Troy, Tennessee, on September 29th and 30th. It was called Operation Diomedes, after the ancient Greek warrior who wounded Aphrodite, the goddess of love. After being helicoptered from Fort Campbell, soldiers were dropped into multiple locations throughout the town. Once on the ground, the soldiers were to clear predetermined buildings in 4 different objective areas based on a combat scenario. Military spokesman said this air assault was the first time that soldiers from the 101st Airborne had conducted such training in the area. The purpose of the exercise was to provide the troops with pertinent, realistic training in unfamiliar terrain to prepare them for possible contingency operations around the world. Some saw this exercise as practice for the military capture of small towns in the United States. Exercises similar to those in Troy and Kingsville may have occurred as early as 1971, when plans were drawn up to merge the military with police and the National Guard. In that year, Senator Sam Ervin's Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights discovered that military intelligence had established an intricate surveillance system to spy on hundreds of thousands of American citizens. Most of the citizens were anti-war protesters. This plan to merge the police with the military included exercises that were codenamed Garden Plot and Cable Splicer. Britt Snyder, who was lead researcher on military intelligence for Irvin's subcommittee, said the plans seemed too vague to get excited about. "We could never find any kind of unifying purpose behind it all," he told a reporter. "It looked like an aimless kind of thing." Yet 4 years later, the plans began to come into sharper focus. In the New Times magazine, Ron Ridenour and Arthur Lubow reported that codenamed Cable Splicer covers California, Oregon, Washington, and Arizona, and is under the command of the 6th Army. It is a plan that outlines extraordinary military procedures to stamp out unrest in this country. Developed in a series of California meetings from 1968 to 1972, Cable Splicer is a war plan that was adapted for domestic use, procedures used by the U.S. Army in Vietnam. Although many facts still remain behind Pentagon smokescreens, Cable Splicer documents reveal the shape of the monster that the Irvin Committee was tracking down. During the time when Cable Splicer was being carried out, several full-scale war games were conducted with local officials and police working side by side with military officers in civilian clothing. Many policemen were taught military urban pacification techniques. Afterward, they returned to their departments and helped create the early SWAT, Special Weapons and Tactics teams. Representative Claire Bergener of California, a staunch Reagan Republican who had attended the Cable Splicer II kickoff conference, was flabbergasted when shown Cable Splicer documents. "This is what I call subversive," he said. Subcommittee Chief Counsel Doug Lee read through the documents and blurted out, "Unbelievable. These guys are crazy. We're the enemy. This is civil war they're talking about here. Half the country has been designated as the enemy." Britt Snyder agreed, stating, "If there ever was a model for takeover, this is it." The war on terrorism and the more recent flu alarms have provided the pretext for the activation of plans like Cable Splicer, which is a clear violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. Diana Reynolds, formerly an assistant professor of politics at Bradford College and a lecturer at Northeastern University, wrote a paper entitled "The Rise of the National Security State, FEMA and the NSC in 1990. In the paper, Reynolds argued, "The Rex 84 Alpha X Plan, Readiness Exercise 1984 Exercise Plan, indicates that FEMA, in association with 34 other federal civil departments and agencies, conducted a civil readiness exercise during April 5th through 13th, 1984. It was conducted in coordination and simultaneously with a Joint Chiefs exercise, Night Train 84, a worldwide military command post exercise, including Continental U.S. Forces, or CONUS, based on multi-emergency scenarios operating both abroad and at home. In the combined exercise, Rex 84 Bravo, FEMA, and DOD led the other federal agencies and departments, including the Central Intelligence Agency, the Secret Service, the Treasury, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Veterans Administration, through a gaming exercise to test military assistance in civil defense. The exercise anticipated civil disturbances, major demonstrations and strikes that would affect continuity of government and/or resource mobilization. To fight subversive activities, there was authorization for the military to implement government-ordered movements of civilian populations at state and regional levels, the arrest of certain unidentified segments of the population, and the imposition of martial rule. In 1984, the military's involvement with civilian authorities inspired then-Attorney General William French Smith to write a critical letter stating, "In short, I believe that the role assigned to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, on the revised executive order exceeds its proper function as a coordinating agency for emergency preparedness." In January 2005, fears that secretive, overreaching agencies with military connections might violate the Posse Comitatus Act were substantiated. During this time, news outlets reported that since 2002, the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, had operated an intelligence gathering and support unit called the Strategic Support Branch, SSB, with authority to operate clandestinely anywhere in the world to support anti-terrorism and counter-terrorism missions. The SSB previously had been unknown, operating under an undisclosed name. Military involvement in daily life has even reached the halls of education. In 2002, the principal of Mount Anthony Union High School in Bennington, Vermont, was shocked to receive a letter from military recruiters demanding a list of all students, including names, addresses, and telephone numbers. Because the school's privacy policy prevented the disclosure of such individual information, the principal told the recruiters, no. However, the principal was soon shocked to learn that buried deep within President Bush's new No Child Left Behind Act, public schools must provide their students' personal information to military recruiters or face a cutoff of federal funds. Republican Representative David Vitter of Louisiana, who sponsored the recruitment requirement in the education bill, noted that in 1999, more than 19,000 U.S. schools denied military recruiters access to their records. Vitter said such schools demonstrated an anti-military attitude that I thought was offensive. What could be offensive about wanting to protect the privacy of the nation's students? I think the privacy implications of this law are profound, commented Jill Wins, president of the San Francisco Board of Education. For the federal government to ignore or discount the concerns of the privacy rights of millions of high school students is not a good thing, and it's something we should be concerned about. Not only are high school students being bothered by Homeland Security, but also mere kindergarten students who want to play outside. In May 2002, Scott and Cassandra Garrick sued the Sayreville School District in New Jersey after their 6-year-old child and 3 classmates were disciplined for playing cops and robbers. Apparently, other students saw the youngsters playing on the schoolyard, pretending to use their fingers as guns. The other students told the teacher and the kindergartners were suspended from school. U.S. District Court Judge Catherine S. Hayden dismissed the parents' civil suit, claiming school authorities have the right to restrict violent or disruptive games. Yet the parents' attorney, Stephen H. Aiden, remarked, "They have the right to be children. The school and the courts shouldn't censor their play even if it's politically incorrect." Incidents like this are rarely covered in the corporate mass media. They are never distributed to a large audience, but they often worry thoughtful people. "I'm terrified," said Ellen Schrecker, author of Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America. "What concerns me is we're not seeing an enormous outcry against this whole structure of repression that's being rushed into place." ACLU President Nadine Strossen also voiced concern. "I've been talking a lot about the parallels between what we're going through now and McCarthyism. The term terrorism is taking on the same kind of characteristics as the term communism did in the 1950s. It stops people in their tracks and they're willing to give up their freedoms. People are too quickly panicked. They're too willing to give up their rights and to scapegoat people, especially immigrants and people who criticize the war." Paul Proctor, a columnist for NewsWithViews.com and periodicals across America, added, "Besides being unconstitutional and un-American, snooping on innocent people in a free society is cowardly, divisive, and just plain evil. But you see, terrorists don't want your freedom. They want your life. It is tyrants and dictators that want your freedom." Deficient Border Patrol. Some people desire to alter or even abolish the Posse Comitatus Act, particularly with regard to border security. In an October 2001 letter to Donald Rumsfeld, Republican Senator John Warner wrote, "Should this law, the PCA, now be changed to enable our active duty military to more fully join other domestic assets in this war against terrorism?" Warner's question continued into late 2002, when then-Representative Tom Tancredo, members of the Immigration Reform Caucus, and families of victims slain in the course of conflicts between immigration officers and illegal aliens, petitioned Congress, demanding that military troops patrol the U.S. borders. Jumping on the anti-terrorist bandwagon, Tancredo stated, "As long as our borders remain undefended, we cannot claim that we are doing everything possible to protect the nation from terrorism. It's time to authorize the deployment of military assets on our borders." During this time, a FEMA official named John Brinkerhoff wrote a paper arguing that President Bush and Congress should initiate action to enact a new law that would set forth in clear terms a statement of the rules for using military forces for homeland security and for enforcing the laws of the United States. Things have changed a lot since 1878, and the Posse Comitatus Act is not only irrelevant, but also downright dangerous to the proper and effective use of military forces for domestic duties. This paper remained on the Homeland Security website well into 2006. Critics have questioned how the massive restructuring of the U.S. government under the Homeland Security Act has helped protect the nation, especially when the national borders are left dangerously open to both the nation's north and south. To many thoughtful Americans, it seems like a common-sense first step in the war on terrorism to tighten security on the U.S. borders. Yet this does not appear to have happened. Despite an increasing clamor for tighter security, a flood of illegal immigrants continues unabated on the southern border. Though politicians spouted rhetoric about building an effective fence, only a few motion sensors and cameras ended up being deployed. In late 2009, Border Patrol Director of Media Relations Lloyd Easterling confirmed that the number of agents on the U.S.-Mexico border would be cut by 384. This would bring the total of agents on the Mexican border to 17,015 and agents on the Canadian border to 2,212. Terrence P. Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, reported that in a review, Homeland Security officials said the Border Patrol's goal for fiscal 2009 was to have 815 of the 8,607 miles of border under effective control. Jeffrey noted, the review also said the Border Patrol's goal for fiscal 2010 was to again have 815 miles of border under effective control, meaning DHS was not planning to secure a single additional mile of border in the coming year. U.S. Customs and Border Protection defines effective control as the Border Patrol's ability to detect and apprehend an illegal immigrant crossing a particular area of the border.